Find inspiration in timeless stories of sacrifice and resilience. Find inspiration in little victories and Herculean tasks, in facing trying times together and overcoming the odds as one. The National World War II Museum in New Orleans is now open, so you can find inspiration in all of these places, and especially within yourself. Visit nationalww2museum.org for timed tickets and safety information.
I got my daughter's hair looking tight, so we hopped in the car and went to Mickey D's to celebrate. I did my thing with these braids meal.
There's a meal for every moment on the McDonald's $1, $2, $3 menu.
Enjoy a tasty McChicken biscuit or chicken McGriddles. Get two of the same or one of each for just $3. Prices and participation may vary. Single item at regular price cannot be combined with combo meal.
Of pages to a printer and handed them to him and said, would you, here, go print a book. And he said, no, you have to have typeset. I said, well, you're a printer. Isn't that what you do? And that is truly how naive I was.
Wow. Okay. So that's how you got your start there. And that's definitely learning from the bottom up.
From the bottom up. Really, I made every mistake that it is humanly possible to make, and some that were inhuman.
Yeah. So where did your, obviously you wrote that, and then you branched into actually writing mystery fiction yourself, correct?
No. Well, I co-wrote a couple of mysteries, but really, please, let's be clear about one thing. I am not a mystery writer.
Okay.
I've written a lot of books and too many articles and columns and papers and so on, but I'm not a real writer. The really good mystery writers are real writers.
Okay.
You know, and I did some things for money, because I was trying to earn a living as a freelancer, and, you know, the publishing company certainly wasn't making any money in its early years. If anything, it was a drain. So, I regard, and I think one of the reasons that I've been fairly successful as a mystery publisher and bookseller is that I regard what mystery writers do as miraculous. I mean, it is looking at a blank sheet of paper, creating a story, but far more important, creating characters that are actually living and breathing in your mind is so extraordinary that I hold them in such high regard. They're godlike figures to me.
Wow. That's, now, as we are talking, you know, this is, like I said, the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. So one thing I'm very interested that, you know, came up that we're able to talk is your perspective on what makes a good mystery story. And then, because that will branch also to any story, what makes something good that will establish success or not with respect to a writer. So you gave one thing, a believable character. Any other aspects that you have found that really sustains a writer to, I guess, overcoming that hurdle of acceptance?
The criteria that I use for regarding mystery fiction as really good or even very rarely but occasionally great are the same criteria that anyone would use for other literary works. You have to have characters that live and breathe. If you're telling a good story, but you don't care what happens to those people, then you're not going to engage your reader for a very long period of time. A story can only go so far. You need to be able to have some characters that matter. In the mystery world, you also have the challenge that literary fiction or straight fiction doesn't have. In a mystery, you have to have a conclusion, a solution. You need the classic Greek arc of a beginning, a middle, and an end. A lot of coming-of-age novels, or what I call New Yorker fiction, nothing really changes. They could be beautifully written, but they're not as compelling to me as really great stories with really great characters. And the third element, which is, it sounds like it should be basic, but it's not usually immediately noticeable, is style. You have to be able to write, in order for me to want to publish your book or to read your book, is you have to be able to write in a way that I've never heard before. I was good friends with Shel Silverstein for a while, and he said something to me that resonated and still does in my mind. This is 20 years later, almost. And he said something, and I said, "Oh my God, that is so perceptive. I've never heard anyone say it like that before." And he said, "Otto, that's why they call me a poet." And that's what I look for in a novel that I want to publish or that I want to read. I want to be able to read something like, "Oh wow, I've never heard that described that way, or I've never heard that explained in those words."
That's actually a good thing, because I've had so many different explanations of what's being looked for, but as a publisher and one who espouses the basic philosophy, you only want to publish the best. So this is the criteria you use to be able to establish that.
Exactly. Exactly right. And when people say, well, mysterious press, well, what do you publish exactly? And I have a very short answer, but it's really from my heart. I said, I publish literary crime fiction. Literary being the part where somebody has a style, where somebody is writing in a way that sometimes approaches poetry.
Right.
And my favorite writers are people like Raymond Chandler, but also the great American espionage writer Charles McCary, who was a poet in real life, and his character is a poet, but the prose is poetry. And that's also true for, I published Joyce Carol Oates, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And she writes in a way that nobody else writes. And you recognize that style. And Thomas H. Cook is another writer, not as well known as some of the others, but just an absolute poet in the way that he phrases his language. James Crumley, who wrote The Last Good Kiss and some other books, was also the kind of writer where, as you were reading it, you were hoping that somebody else would be nearby so that you could say, hey, listen to this. Listen to this sentence. And when you read that and you see that and you feel that, you know you've got something special on your hands.
Right. Right. Well, that makes sense. And that's literary mystery fiction. So one of the things I brought up, and you said, I don't know that I really recognize that as a subgenre, but I mentioned to you the whole thing of science fiction mystery books. And so I'd like to discuss that for a little bit, because there is, like, some of the ones that I was, you know, in that list I sent you with Chris Rush, who's one of our judges, actually. He wrote The Disappeared. Tim Powers, another one of our judges, The Anubis Gates. John Varley was one of our judges, Steel Beach. And then Alfred Bester with his Demolished Man. And then they also listed Douglas Adams, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. But these were all listed as science fiction mystery books. What's your view on that? I'd like to discuss that for a bit.
It's it's a tricky thing. You know, when you first mentioned that to me, I said, that's not a genre. And I guess it is, but it's got very few. It doesn't have that many examples of
it. Yeah.
Mysteries in the classic sense of a mystery, meaning a mystery, something that needs to be solved. And obviously we're talking about crime here when we talk about mysteries in the way that we're doing, the way that we're discussing it. We're not talking about metaphysical works where there are greater mysteries than any of us can ever answer.
Right.
So we're talking about mystery fiction, detective fiction, crime fiction. It is something that, yes, science fiction can have that element. So can a Western.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sheriff is the private detective, or he's the police officer, or whatever. Right. So can fantasy fiction. You generally, a lot of people confuse, say, oh, well, you publish mysteries, so you must like horror or supernatural. I said, no, they're diametrically opposed. Supernatural elements in a mystery generally take away the whole concept of solving a mystery, because it's not based on rationality anymore. It's not based on observation and deduction. It's based on supernatural elements. Now, there are examples where it crosses over, and those are amazing tours de force. Randall Garrett did it in his Lord Darcy series, where he created another universe where the laws of magic apply. And he still was able to write a locked room mystery. It's just an amazing achievement.
Yeah.
To some degree, William Hertzberg with Fallen Angel did that, crossing over between two genres. And science fiction really is a detective story, just happens to be set in the future. Caves of Steel by Isaac Asimov is a great example of that. It's a real detective story. It just happens to be set in a future time.
So based upon that, for someone who's, like I said, who's an aspiring writer, or even someone who's been writing for a while and wants to be able to bridge that and know the do's and don'ts, or things to steer clear of on addressing mystery, and really that demarcation between what's mystery versus what's not, as it applies to science fiction, what would be some of the guidelines you'd recommend to writers to follow and to stay clear of?
Well, I just touched on them. You have to. The first part is constructing a mystery, the plot of a mystery. You need a crime that is not evident. I mean, or who committed it, or why it was committed, or how it was committed. At least one of those elements has to be involved in the crime, and then you have to have an investigation, whether it's by an official policeman, by an amateur detective, or private eye, it doesn't matter. Somebody has to serve as the person who wants to solve that mystery. And then you have to have a solution that is logical and rational. You can't suddenly say, oh, a ghost came from nowhere and killed him and disappeared. And you can't do that. So the mystery element comes first. And then your background. Your background could be a Western town in America in 1820, or it could be the planet Jupiter in the year 3 million. The background is the background that you're comfortable writing in. And I don't care about that very much. I care about the mystery element and having its tropes used in the proper fashion.
Okay, well, that's actually very good advice on that, because, I mean, we've had several of our Writers of the Future winners go on into other genres. We had Karen Joy Fowler, who obviously made her big splash with the Jane Austen Book Club, but Jill Beverly with, she became one of the masters of romance. Nancy Farmer in The House of the Scorpion, that won a National Book Award. Virginia Baker wrote Jackknife and other stories. So we've got, it's important that even if a person's doing their entry, because Writers of the Future affords an aspiring writer an opportunity to be able to break in, but they don't have to stick with that genre. They can move on to other areas, which others have very successfully done. So what you're talking about in this discussion, I think, is really important for them to be able to have some more tips and some more inspiration of what to do, how to be able to expand in that area.
Well, to some degree, I agree. I think that's all to the good. I will say that what we've only been talking about here is the art, is the creativity, is the work, the manuscript, the book. What we're not touching on is actually selling that book. And if you are crossing genres or mixing genres, it can be very tricky, very difficult sometimes to sell that book, to market that book, because I'm a bookseller, as you know, in addition to being a publisher. So if we get a book in here, well, it's easier for us because our store sells only mystery fiction. So if it happens to have a 2,000-year-old background or a 100-year-old background or a 500-year-in-the-future background, or it's set in a foreign country or in a different time or place, they're still all mysteries in my store. But if you go to a bigger store that has sections, they have history, they have science fiction, they have mystery fiction, they have Western fiction. And if you're crossing genres, where do they put the book? So if you have a mystery fan who wants to read a mystery and doesn't care if it's in the future or if it's in the West or in a submarine, they just want mysteries. But if you have put that book in your science fiction section, or your Western section, or your history section, historical fiction section, you may not find that book. So you have an additional, it sounds like you have more opportunities because you're covering more than one genre. On the other hand, you're putting yourself at some risk because you may want to be selling it as a mystery that happens to be set in the future, but it's going to be set in the science fiction section. And if the main thrust of that book is a mystery, a real science fiction fan may say, this isn't what I want. I want something different.
Good. So you need to know what you're getting into when you get into it. So if you're going to write a book, and it's like you said, it's actually a mystery with a science fiction setting, then it needs to be sold as a mystery book if that's really what it is.
Yeah, the dust jacket needs to make it clear that this is not just a science fiction book, or conversely, that it's not just a mystery book, that it's a combination. You can do that with art on the cover. You could do that with the right title. You could do it with flap copy or cover copy. You can do it in a variety of ways, but it's something that both the author and the publisher needs to pay attention to so that it doesn't fall between two stools.
Okay, that's very good. That's a very good point on that. Now, one thing I've not talked about with anybody else before, which you just brought up, though, is the dust jacket, the cover. So in your experience as a bookseller and as a publisher, how significant, how important is the cover or dust jacket to the sale, whether it be impulse or actually someone's going around and just looking, I need a good whatever genre they want for a customer like that?
It's life and death. It's life and death for the book. If you have a bad jacket, I don't care how great that book is. If you're, you know, if you're a typical buyer, I'm not talking about an established author. I'm not talking about a small store where the proprietor is going to hand sell you a book. If you are the typical buyer in a, let's say, I don't like to use this language as an independent bookseller, but let's say you're in a Barnes & Noble and you're browsing the shelves and you're looking for something that inspires you. You say, no, I really want to read a great mystery. What am I going to buy? And you're looking at covers and you're pulling books off the shelf. If it has a lousy dust jacket, you're never even going to open the book. It'll never make it. So it doesn't matter how bad the jacket on a Stephen King or a John Grisham or James Patterson book. It makes no difference. It's a Stephen King or a John Grisham or James Patterson. And if you're a fan of those very, very popular writers, you're going to want the book. I don't care if it's a blank sheet of paper on there with a title and the author's name. It's not going to matter. Right. But if you're a first novelist or a second or a third time novelist, and what we call a mid-list author, meaning somebody who's not selling hundreds of thousands of copies, you need the support of a really good jacket. Look, at Mysterious Press, we pay a lot of money to a very good studio to come up with good covers that my publisher, Charles, and I spend, or if it's a Scarlet title, a different imprint that I have, Louisa, we work with that artist and with that studio really hard to get the right cover to reflect what's in the book in a colorful, interesting, compelling way.
Do you require that the artist read the book or at least a summary of it?
Yes. He cannot possibly do a really good cover that reflects the book unless he or she reads something that gives that gives a really serious idea of what the book is like. We generally will supply that with catalog copy, flap copy, a summary of the book. But frequently, most of the good artists that we work with actually read part of the book to get a sense of style, in addition to the rudiments of the plot. You know, you can write a thriller in any number of ways. It can be really violent. It could take you across continents, across countries, with multiple villains, dynamite, car chases. You could do all of those things. Or it could be a domestic thriller where a lone person is being stalked by a single person with a very different style. And you can't always tell that in a very brief summary. You want to know what the style is, or what the focus of that book is. And you can do that best by reading some pages. And they almost always do.
Okay, that's good advice also for the artists listening to this. Something that's a good tip for success then. Now, on the subject of mysteries, I'm going back now to Pulp Fiction days. You know, there was, you know, because on this list that I read you, there's definitely some of the earlier writers of the mystery pulp fiction. Going back on that one I just said there was I think The Demolished Man by Alfred Bester, that was in 52, but even going earlier. How has pulp fiction, well, first of all, what impact has pulp fiction had on current mystery writing? And maybe describe like the evolution as you've observed from the original days of the mystery magazines to the current mystery.
I read a lot of pulps. I know you know that.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I published or Random House has published several books of pulp fiction that I've edited for Random House. So I read a lot of pulp, but I also read a lot of 19th century fiction. I was a huge fan of, well, in addition to Sherlock Holmes, which everybody should be,
yes,
but Wilkie Collins and Charles Dickens, who most of whose books have mystery and crime elements. And then there were other books set in the early 20th century, and then the pulps became very popular, and then other things moved on. So the pulps were part of a time. The 20s, 30s, and 40s were really the time of the pulps. I think in those pulp days, a lot of writers were earning so little for each story. You know, the famous line is that they earned a penny a word. So they wrote very quickly, and a lot of really bad fiction was written in the pulps, mm-hmm. because these writers were trying to write 3,000 words a day, and they weren't taking time to rewrite and polish and edit and look for the perfect word to fit in exactly where they needed it, le mot juste. So they were writing very quickly. Now, the really good writers could write quickly and still wrote brilliantly. Hammett and Chandler are the two examples that I know best. But there were so many really talented writers working, and some of their stories were outstanding and some weren't, because they were writing so much, some were just better than others. And so the influence of early 20th century fiction to the pulp era were a lot of words, because people like Dickens and other writers of the 19th century also got paid by the words. Dickens, most of his books were published in weekly parts, and he had to write enough to fill 20, generally 19, they call them 20 weekly parts, and then the last one was two parts in one. And so each week there were these chapters of his book, and so he was writing, but had to write enough to get the reader to want to make sure that he bought the next book, the next installment. So we had to have enough thrilling stuff ending each element of those books. In the pulps, in addition to the short stories, a lot of pulps ran serials and serial novels, and the exact same thing pertained. If you didn't hook that reader at the very end, they weren't going to care about what happened next week if it was a weekly pulp, or next month if it was a monthly pulp. So you had to have that hook that kept that reader wanting to read it. Now, you look at publishing today, look at James Patterson, probably the most successful writer in the world, and his books have short chapters. And every chapter, or just about every chapter, ends with a hook that makes the reader want to turn the page and keep moving. Mickey Spillane did very similar things back in the 40s, late 40s and 50s. You know, sort of these cliffhanger chapter endings that made you want to read. And I think that was inherited to a large degree from the pulps.
Okay, that's... Because also during the pulp period too, you had the depression happening. You had post World War I, pre World War II. So there was a lot of people wanted to be able to escape. So it was also referred to as escapist fiction that people, for at least a little bit, could be, you know, away from their out of work, or threat of being out of work, or afraid of being sent away to a war that was unpopular or at least unknown what was going to happen.
Sure. But you know, people have frequently described genre fiction, science fiction, mystery fiction, Western fiction, as escapist literature.
Right.
But all fiction is escapist. If you're not involved, if you are reading something good, you're involved in that book. You are totally committed to that book, and you're in another world, whether that world is at sea with Moby Dick or Captain's Courageous, or if it's on another planet, or if it's in a drawing room where somebody has just been murdered. That all fiction is escapist. It's not just popular or genre fiction.
Right. Okay. So now on when we earlier met, we were just re-releasing our Stories from the Golden Age, which we were republishing 153 of the stories that were pulp fiction stories that were written by Owen Hubbard there in the 30s and 40s, a few of them in the 50s, but mostly 30s and 40s. And I mean, it's interesting because when we were doing that, we did a lot of research into it to be able to put them out there. And Philip Dick wrote that his fear shaped the way that I write. Arthur Clarke had several letters when he was a young person talking about Hubbard as a writer. And then later on, when he wrote the Mission Earth series, you're saying he was amazed at the energy of Hubbard. You said you've read some of his Pulp Fiction works, but any particular comments about his Pulp Fiction? Because he obviously went on to create Writers of the Future, and he did a lot of essays at the time in the 30s and 40s for writers that he published in various writing magazines, Writer's Digest and whatnot.
He was a really good pulp writer. There's no denying that. I've read so many pulp stories by so many people that, you know, there are some that stand out. And, you know, I think he was at the top of his form. He was as good as any, just about any. I don't think anybody was as good as Raymond Chandler or Dashiell Hammett. That's just me.
Sure.
It's all subjective. We all have our favorite things. They were the two giants that bestrode the genre. But, you know, and a lot of, so many writers were hugely prolific. Hubbard was certainly one of them. He wrote a lot of stories.
Yeah.
But there, you know, there were so many writers working in that field. They worked really hard. And one of the things that's been, I don't know, about 100 and how many books did you say you reissued?
Well, we reissued 153 when we did that. We've since found another 100 that either weren't published or were partially finished. I've got, like, on the old Doc Methuselah series, which is science fiction, but there were two unfinished stories that S.M. Sterling is finishing for us. But
okay.
He was quite prolific then.
Okay. You know, I've rescued some stories that had never been reissued and so on. And in many cases, I had to read quite a few stories to find the actual terrific story by that writer who I wanted to include in a book. I mean, no offense to anybody. I'm not sure that all 153 books are the top quality of what he wrote.
And he didn't even say, he said it wasn't, but some of them actually were top for that genre. And other ones were good stories. Heinlein commented about Hubbard's storytelling as that it was a story line that he would use, which was the man that learned better. So a lot of his stories were, you know, someone that's in a, he's not necessarily a good guy. He's just a guy getting on in life, and he doesn't always do the right thing. And then he's put into a position where he's got to make a decision to do the right thing. And then his stories, he does, and or usually does. And then that's something that a lot of people were able to relate to when he wrote those in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And when we republished them, that was some of the things that was continued to be said about them, that it's because they're people stories, which is why Street and Smith pulled him into writing with Astounding, because it was Astounding was so not people stories at the time, that pretty much holds true. People are people now like they were back then, and some of the different things that people do don't change, which is maybe why, like you mentioned, Chandler and Hammett, you know, they're people and they're real people, and that's you can still relate to them now.
Absolutely. This is where we started when I was talking about character.
Yeah.
You know, it really is the most important element of a book. I mean, obviously you need the story and you need an interesting background. You want to learn something when you're reading. So, you know, you have to have a full background of interesting material. You need some style, but really it boils down to the rudiment, which is that you've got to have a character that you care about. And obviously that's the case in Hubbard's books.
And in any book that actually survives the test of time, it's that character. You can still relate to them, even though they're wearing different clothes or they have to double clutch to shift a gear. It's still
sure
something you can relate to.
Absolutely. And that's timeless. I mean, you can read a 19th century book or an 18th century book by the real masters, and the situations that are encountered, the characters' responses to those situations are universal if the writer is at the top of his form.
Yeah,
and that's why we still know characters from the 19th century. We still know characters from Dickens. We know Mr. Pickwick. We know Oliver Twist and David Copperfield. We know those characters. They survived because Dickens could create characters that were universal. We related to them in 1860, and we relate to them now in 2021.
Whatever year it is.
I can't believe it's 2021. Oh my God, I'm so old.
No, it's true. Ebenezer Scrooge is still a classic character, you know, that so many years later.
Sure.
You know, people can definitely relate to him. So in terms of the future of publishing, what have you observed? Because I know digital has been, it was a major, from my experience on the ebooks, that was a really major boom, you know, decade ago, and then it kind of leveled off. It picked up again with the last year's pandemic, but then the print book seems to have stopped receding. It's like holding its own. What's been your experience on this right now?
Well, you know, the minute that ebooks were invented, people started talking about the death of the book. But of course, they started talking about the death of the book when radio first came on. And people said, oh, well, people are going to stop reading because they're going to listen to the radio. And then again, the death of the book when television and movies became popular. Oh, nobody's going to do this. Then the death of the book when video games became popular. Then the death of the book when ebooks became popular. But, you know, last year, 2020, the number of physical books, hard paper copies of books, increased over the previous year. So yes, ebooks did tremendously well because people weren't going to ball games or concerts or movie theaters and so on. They couldn't go out to play, you know, games. They couldn't go out, so they were staying home and they were reading. And a lot of people did it with real books. My Mysterious Press is a regular publishing company. We publish our books in hardcover and paperback and ebook. But I also have an e-publishing company called MysteriousPress.com with about 2,000 titles of great writers, classic writers, that we publish exclusively as ebooks. And yes, they did tremendously well. They were very successful and have been every year since we started. So there is a definitely a new way of reading a book. But the number of people who still come into my store and say, you know, I read this book as an ebook, but I liked it so much I want it in my library. Or I've read so many ebooks, I'm really tired of reading on my screen. I want to read a physical book. And there are people who value the physical presence of a book, the feel of the book. Look, when you, and I don't know if your whole audience, I don't know about you, I don't know about anybody listening, if they have the same experience, but I'd be willing to bet a lot of money that some do. You've read books physically. You remember the book. You remember what the dust jacket looked like. You remember where you were when you read the book because it made such an impression on you. That isn't true with ebooks. You don't remember the same, you don't have the same experience. You didn't have the visceral sense of touching the book, of turning the page. When you go back to the book, yeah, you can find your place in an ebook where you left off. But if you want to go back and look at something, it's not the same as flipping pages in a real book and finding that. Okay, I'm a bookseller. I'm a book person. I was a collector. I collected 60,000 first editions of mystery fiction.
How many?
Which is insane. 60.
Holy 60. Moly. Wow.
Yeah, it's insane. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, to any sane person. Because it does take over your life. I had to build a house to hold. So I'm a book person. I'm an old-fashioned book person. And I have an e-publishing company, as I just said, 20,000 titles. I don't have an e-reader. I don't read on a screen if I could possibly avoid it. I want to read a physical book. But that sense, but even people who read a lot of things on the screen. I hear it all the time, every day in my bookshop. People who have read are reading on the screen, whether it's on their phone or a PC or whatever device they do it. But they're walking to my store and they say, no, I want a real book. I want to have that experience because it's so different. So I think one of the things, and I don't mean to just keep rattling on here, but you said, what about the future of the book? The future of the book is solid. And I'll tell you something else. More people are starting to value the physical object. There are more collectors in the last few years than there were 10 years ago. And there are more people who are looking at the quality of the book. How well is this produced? No, I don't want a mass market paperback. I want a hardcover. Oh, I don't want a trade paperback. I want a hardcover. Because they value the physical entity, not just what's in the book, not just the words, the prose, you know, the beauty of it all, but the actual physical item. And it, so I think the future of the book is extremely solid.
Well, that's good. I read something recently about Gen Z, the 20 somethings, who live on devices have been migrating more and more towards a hard book to read, because there's so much on a phone, on a device, that it's just, it totally, that transports, you know, you by holding that book, that visceral feeling you're talking about, seems to be an interesting phenomenon that's happening with the younger generation now, that they're going back to that. Have you observed like younger people getting?
Yes. Yes. It's one of the things, it's one of the demographics, if we can use that word, of what I was just talking about. People coming in saying, you know, I've been reading so much on the screen. I really want the sensibility of holding this book, of smelling it, of walking into a library or a bookstore and smelling the books. You know, it's a different experience entirely. And I'm seeing it with teenagers. I'm seeing it with little kids. I'm seeing it with 20s, with every age group. And the older folks, many of whom have gone to a Kindle, if you'll excuse the expression. I don't like to talk about Amazon because they're an evil empire.
Okay.
But they have switched to that because, yes, you can change the size of the type and you can illuminate it from the back. And as you get older and older and your eyes start to have more and more issues, I can understand why people then would want to read on a screen. I do understand that. But almost everybody, right across every age group, every demographic, is at least the people I encounter. You know, I don't work in an Apple store, so I might not have the same experience. I work in a bookstore, so everybody who comes in here is not looking for an electronic book. They're looking to get away from it and have the experience of a real book.
That's interesting. I read a lot on a screen now, but I'm just listening to you, what you're saying there. I usually, like, I'm rushed. My life is rushed. And so I read to prepare for a podcast. I read to prepare for an interview. I prepare, you know, I do it for that, to prepare for that. And just, but if I want to be able to just relax and enjoy, which is such a rarity, I like the hardback book. I like to sit down and read in that field of paper and just kind of like, at my own pace, just go through and enjoy a book. And it's
absolutely, yeah. Well, we're the same. Look, you know, I have to read a lot of manuscripts because I publish original fiction.
Right.
And I can read 5 or 10 pages on the screen. If something looks really good, or let me add to that, if it's an author that I'm already publishing and I have to read the book and edit the book, I print it out. I print it out and then make all my editorial notes and things on a printed page, because I can't do it on the screen. I can't concentrate the same way that I can with the physical presence of a hard copy.
And you certainly can't mark it up. I haven't figured out how to mark it up and make it stay when I do it on the screen. You know, it's just...
I'm no good at it. Everybody on my staff can do it, and virtually every author that I work with can do it. But I turn it over to my publisher and I say, here, we got the author's responses from the copy editor who did it you know, with blue lines and red lines or whatever they are,
mm-hmm.
all these things on the screen. Can you help me? Because I can't even open these things. I can't even read them,
yeah.
much less fix them. So you know, it's a burden that that I've had to pass along to somebody a lot smarter than I am.
The one thing I do like about reading a digital version of a book is to be able to highlight the word and then go to the dictionary right away. I'm fastidious about clearing words, understanding the words that I'm reading. And so if I run into a word I don't understand in a book, I have to look it up. So I can, okay, what's he saying? Because if you don't understand the word, how can you understand his concept? So it's really nice on the K word, the Kindle, to be able to highlight the word and it opens up into a dictionary so I can then fully understand that word and then what's the definition the author is using on that. My vocabulary expands as a result, but I also end up understanding the story, you know, much better.
Sure.
So that's the one thing I really like about that. Otherwise, the sense of just holding the book is like, I agree with you. It's with that extra dimension that it provides, it's much more pleasurable. I do remember them better. I wasn't thinking like that before, but now that you know, thinking as you were saying that stuff, that holds true. Because I totally remember, like, you know, so many years ago reading Call of the Wild, you know, just that still, I can picture what the book looked like. I got it at a Texaco gas station when they had the Book of the Month Club, and I saved my, it was $1.99, whatever, and I got it, and I read it, and I was just like, oh, I love this book, and Moby Dick, and just, you know, those Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn, you know, I totally remember what they felt like, what they looked like, the dust jackets, and it's just, they stay with me now, so many years later.
There you go, John. You've just I rest my case.
You do indeed. Indeed. And just some amazing pleasure moments you just brought back for me with that. That was great.
Yeah, we all read so much for work on the screen. And like you, I'm rushed all the time. I get 300 or 400 emails every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that stuff and then respond to it quickly. And it's great for all of that. But for reading for pleasure, the screen is just not going to do it for me.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. Yeah. I mean, that's such a good point you made. And if nothing else, even if nobody else listens to this, which I know it's not going to be the case, I feel great from just what we talked about just now and that.
Trip down memory lane of reading books when we were kids or young people and finding, you know, that memory comes back. About what that book looked like and where you were when you read it. You know, I remember reading The Count of Monte Cristo. I was forced to go to bed at a certain time. And I had, it's trite, it's a cliche, but I literally had my flashlight under the blankets. You know, I was 11 years old or 10 years old, 12 maybe, I don't remember exactly. And I'm reading, and I read that book. I still remember how it was always under, that's where I was, where I read most of the book, was with a blanket covering my flashlight so that I could continue reading. I couldn't stop it. You want to, and talk about a book that still resonates today with a character who understood vengeance, who understood the concept of revenge. Edmond Dantès was that character, and yeah. I still love that book.
Wow, that was at least 20 years ago, huh?
At least, yeah.
So now I've talked about lots of different things, but anything else that you can think of as a publisher that you would like to tell the aspiring writer or somebody who's got a manuscript they're shopping around, do's and don'ts of how to shop a manuscript?
Well, you know, so there are the basics, which is, you know, you type it, make sure you check your spell check, you know, get rid of the typos. When you think you've finished it, read it one more time, because you probably will discover things that you didn't see the first or second time through, especially if you've given it a little time. When somebody has spent 6 months or a year writing a book, there's a sense of urgency. I want this out there. I want to get this out there. I want to get this read. I want to find an agent, or I want to find a publisher. And you want to do all of those things, but it's really smart to put it aside for a couple of weeks and come back to it and read it one more time. I would focus. You cannot focus enough on the first 20 pages.
I got my daughter's hair looking tight. So we hopped in the car and went to Mickey D's to celebrate. I did my thing with these braids meal.
There's a meal for every moment on the McDonald's $1, $2, $3 menu.
Enjoy a tasty McChicken biscuit or chicken McGriddles. Get two of the same or one of each for just $3. Prices and participation may vary. Single item at regular price cannot be combined with combo meal.
Are you a gig worker or self-employed? Womply has helped over 100,000 small businesses get a PPP stimulus loan and proudly serves more than 600,000 small businesses across America. Millions of self-employed workers may qualify for up to $41,000 in 100% forgivable loans. So, apply today. The program ends soon, and funds are limited. Apply now at womply.com/apply and see if you qualify for a PPP loan. Womply.com/apply. That's WOMPLY.com/apply.